I think you're down there, but get your chair and bring it down here.
Andy. Hey, Tim, how are you?
We've got seniority.
America that makes stone.
Let's call this meeting of the Legislative Energy Commission to order. And then you can all get out of here very quickly as soon as we're finished. So let's get moving. A couple of years ago, there were a number of rate rider requests, and the legislature at that time thought maybe it was would be a good idea to look at this process of rate riders versus the contested rate hearings and find out if there are advantages or disadvantages to either process. And so we asked the legislative PUC rather to do a study of the rate riders and get back to us and give us a report. And the report is here. I think you all have copies of it. Okay. And and we have the Public Utilities Commission here today to give us an oral report on that utility rate study. And so at this time, I'd like to ask David Boyd, Burl Haar, and Janet Gonzalez to come to the table. David. Dr. Boyd, you're not coming up? Okay. Okay. Mr. Haar. Dr. Haar.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you very much, and members. Good to see you all again. Hope everybody's having a good summer. As mentioned with me today is Chairman David Boyd, Chairman of the Commission, Janet Gonzalez.
Dr. Haar, just turn the microphone up a little bit. I think it'll pick
that,
you up
that better.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Also with me, obviously, at the table is Janet Gonzalez, who is the manager of our energy unit, and also Mr. Chris Fittipaldi, who is a financial analyst with the commission, and he helped prepare the report. You should have a copy of the report as well as some slides that that I've prepared for the discussion today. The laws of Minnesota in 2009, Chapter 111, required the Commission, as you pointed out, Madam Chair, to prepare a utility rates study, and specifically, the Commission was to assess special mechanisms that allow cost recovery outside of general rate case proceedings for specific types of expenditures. The law required the Commission to consult with the Office of Energy Security, and as noted in the report, the Commission had a public meeting with the OES as well as other interested parties. That was back in January, and the Commission also allowed or accepted written comments from the parties and as well as the OES, and many of those comments are reflected in the report. However, as noted on the cover page, this is a report of the Commission, so we take ownership in the contents of it, even though we benefited greatly from the advice of OES as well as the other parties. The report is intended to provide a framework for a further discussion on these issues. It doesn't come to any definitive silver bullet solutions, perhaps, unfortunately, but hopefully it provides a good framework for thought, understanding the effects of using special recovery mechanisms and maybe some options for doing it in a better way. The specific issues that the Commission was asked to address are shown on slide 2. And I'll just be kind of moving through these slides as I talk along here. Each of those is covered in the report, and I will be summarizing our comments on those today. I'm not going to get into all the gory details, but I hope to hit the main points. Before we get into the specifics of those issues, I think it's important to review some of the background on rate making, just to set a sort of a context for how these special rate recovery mechanisms have evolved and their role in the rate making process. Looking then at slide 3, utility rate-making activities in Minnesota typically fall into three general categories. The most prominent one is the general rate case. That's, of course, the Commission's primary instrument for utility rate-making. We have the special recovery mechanisms now, and that's, of course, the subject of main subject of this report. And then there are also occasional miscellaneous filings deal with tariff issues, services, and adjustments, but those are fewer, I guess, in number. As mentioned, the study focuses on the effects of increasing reliance on special recovery mechanisms, particularly as it differs from the traditional rate-making process using rate cases as the primary instrument. And to that end, I'd like to review some basic principles and concepts of traditional rate-making. Moving on to slide 4, which discusses or focuses on the rate case process. The goal of the rate-making generally, very generally, is to establish just and reasonable rates. That's right out of statute. The focus is on keeping rates affordable for utility customers, and that involves assessing the impact of rate changes on different classes of customers and how those rates are structured. It also involves ensuring utility operations are efficient and that their financial profile is sufficiently balanced so to keep their financing costs to a minimum. Financing costs for utilities is a significant issue because they're very capital-intensive industries, and therefore those costs are substantial for utilities. So it's something that the Commission and regulators generally need to be paying a lot of attention to. The rate case process itself involves two main components, the revenue requirement, which seeks to identify the costs of operation, assets used and useful for the provision of electricity services, and then what's a reasonable rate of return to allow on those assets. That's the revenue requirement part. And then there's the rate design part, which seeks to assess the impact on rate classes and set rates that give proper price signals to end users. Because this report, the utility rates report, focuses on cost recovery, particularly the focus here is on the first element, which is the revenue requirement. Turning then to the next slide, slide 5, on cost recovery. Cost recovery is based on what we call a reasonable opportunity principle under our system of economic regulation. And according to that concept or that theory, regulation should provide a reasonable opportunity to earn a return that recovers costs that were prudently incurred and necessary for the provision of safe and reliable utility service, including financing costs and a reasonable return on investors. However, a reasonable opportunity principle does not provide that the return should be a guarantee of recovery. I think we've tried to emphasize that in previous presentations here, that is an authorized return is indeed an authorized return, is not a guaranteed return. The principle is part of the structure of economic regulation in the United States, where entities deemed to be affected with the public interest are granted an exclusive franchise, and in return for that are subject to rate regulation by public bodies. The exclusive franchise provided to the utilities for providing what is usually regarded as an essential service provides considerable financial security to the franchise holder, as you can imagine. The rate regulation of rates ensures that the exclusive franchise is not going to be abused, that the monopoly power, in other words, is not going to be abused. The goal, as we've mentioned here, of the process is to establish rates that are reasonable, that are adequate to provide safe and reliable service, and also to provide sufficient return to allow utilities to attract capital. So the process of setting rates that are in the public interest requires a balancing of utility financial viability with a sense of what's reasonable for ratepayers. Turning then to slide 6, the components of a rate of a revenue requirement of the revenue requirement portion of a rate case are summarized in this slide. Utilities, when they file a petition, will include a total annual level of revenues that it claims it needs to provide reliable service what they believe is a typical year. It's what we call a test year. It's sort of a snapshot of what the utility believes the future will bring and how that affects their costs and operations. So that is a fundamental part of evaluating the rate case process. In Minnesota, utilities can use historical test years adjusted for known and measurable changes, or they can use a forecasted test year, which looks completely into the future and projects, tries to provide a projection or an estimate of what's coming, so that the rates are as forward-looking as they can be. At least that's the way the theory is designed. There are many factors that affect that future scenario, but the basic components are those listed there in that second bullet, which are the operating expenses, current depreciation, which is basically a return of capital to investors, and then return on rate base, which is the value of assets times the rate of return, and that's the return on capital investments. That's the profit, in other words. Those are the main pieces of what go into the revenue requirement. An important characteristic of a rate case proceeding is that it looks at all costs and revenue factors in one proceeding. In other words, those that are increasing as well as those that are decreasing. Obviously, increasing costs are some factors will offset decreases in others. And it's that balancing that the commission spends a lot of time examining and evaluating. In the rate case process, the commission can account for those offsets, and which helps to lessen the impact overall on rates. That's sort of the advantage of the rate case process, one of them anyway. Looking at slide 7, then, the rate case process itself, just in terms of the steps, are largely defined in statute. Procedural steps are defined in Chapter 216B.16. There are a whole string of rules that go along in helping to implement that. This is a fairly involved section of the statute that goes through all of the details of how rate cases are to be processed. One of the key aspects of our process here in Minnesota is that utilities decide when to file the rate case. It's largely their discretion. There are some states where there's a more definite schedule that's established, but here the utilities basically make that decision. Utilities filing effectively is a 60-day notice to the commission of the utility's intent to change its rates. Commission must act within that 60-day period, or the rates can go into effect by operation of law. The first major action after a rate case filing, therefore, is typically the suspension of the utility's proposed rate change and establishment of interim rates. Interim rates are a temporary rate increase intended to address the utility's increased revenue needs during the course of the rate case proceeding. Minnesota's statute requires the commission to establish interim rates on a make-whole theory. In other words, they're intended to provide an increase sufficient to cover utilities' claim financial imperatives during that period of the rate case. And once the filing is accepted, the commission must then reach its final decision within 10 months of acceptance of the filing. Otherwise, the rate increase proposed by the utility goes into effect, again, by operation of law. That's another aspect that is somewhat different than some other states. Not all states have a very specific deadline. The commission now, of course, as a result of some legislation passed recently, does have the authority to extend that 10 months up to an additional 90 days because of workload issues, or in the instance which is not uncommon, where utility rate cases are filed pretty much, you know, right on top of the other, and that does happen occasionally. And that creates significant workload issues for both us as well as OES. So the the ability to extend that that deadline is very helpful. Under traditional regulation, there is a delay. I'm looking at slide 8 now. There is a delay between the incurrence of costs and the implementation of the rates to allow recovery of those costs. In regulatory parlance, this is called regulatory lag. And the lag has really kind of two components. It's the time taken by utility management to sort of assess the situation and to judge whether or not a rate case is really warranted. And then the rest of it is the time taken from for the regulatory process, the administrative process, to run its course from the time the rate case is filed until the final rates are actually established. So there's kind of those two components. In terms of the first component, utility management has to determine if, as I said, conditions warrant filing a rate case, and as noted here, if costs are generally rising and or if revenues are falling, demand is dropping, there's probably a greater incentive to file rate cases because it's putting financial pressure on the utility. On the other hand, if costs are flat or maybe even declining generally, or if revenues are increasing because of an expanding economy, the rates from the last rate case might be perfectly adequate to allow the utility to recover its cost, reasonable opportunity to recover its cost, and earn the return that it needs to satisfy its financial needs. So those conditions generally go into sort of the calculus that the utility management, I presume, would use in making that decision. And then, of course, as I said, the second component is the administrative process. The once a rate case is filed, these cases are complex. They involve complicated issues of corporate finance, and there are very deliberate due process steps that have to be followed. Typically, the utilities will claim that the rates from the last case are not providing them a reasonable opportunity to recover the costs they prudently incurred, and therefore there needs to be an adjustment. And, of course, the interim rates are an attempt to or a provision that allows them to address that risk during the course of the administrative process. So it's important to remember, I guess, that the delay in changing rates can work both ways for utilities. Regulatory lag can work both ways for utilities. And to a very significant degree, utilities in Minnesota can influence the extent of that delay. Looking then at slide 9, there are some, I should say, rate cases, I think the rate case process typically can assure reasonable recovery in most cases, my personal opinion, I guess. But there are conditions that, under the traditional approach, can make it difficult to adhere to a reasonable cost recovery opportunity principle. If cost conditions change dramatically and are unpredictable, if they're substantial in magnitude and are largely beyond the control of the utility, this can create issues, can create problems for the utility's ability to reasonably recover prudently incurred costs. There's some things that can be controlled, some things that can't, and there are some examples that I'll get to in just a minute. Without some sort of special recovery mechanism under those kinds of conditions, utilities would undoubtedly have an incentive to file rate cases more often if they were facing large cost increases that were very volatile and which they really had no or very limited ability to control. They would probably have to be filing rate cases much more frequently than they are. So special recovery mechanisms in those cases help to minimize the need for that. And also a special recovery mechanism in these cases provide a means of adjusting to those specific those conditions and provide perhaps better pricing signals. The classic case is, as noted here, are the fuel costs. Fuel costs are a significant cost, as you can imagine, for electric and particularly natural gas utilities. They can change dramatically. As we've seen in not too long ago, the natural gas prices, for example, were very volatile and changed very, very dramatically. It was a significant issue. And their prices are largely unregulated. Natural gas is an unregulated commodity for the most part, and at least fuel prices are not something that utilities have a very significant amount of direct control over. So Minnesota, like most states, has had a special recovery mechanism in place for fuel costs for quite a number of years. Special recovery for fuel costs help to address financial risks associated with those costs, thereby helping to preserve credit financial ratings. It diminished the need for frequent rate cases, thereby avoiding those costs or minimizing those costs. And by tracking both increases and decreases in fuel costs, they can provide end users with better pricing signals. So the case seems to be pretty clear that in the case of fuel costs, special recovery mechanisms have a very meritorious purpose. But in recent years, and I'm on to slide 10 now, in recent years there's been many more special recovery mechanisms that have been added in Minnesota. These have come about largely as a result of or in combination with specific policy, public policy objectives and expectations placed on utilities where significant investments, for example, quite often are involved in other types of measures. In most of these cases, the underlying cost factors do not neatly fit sort of that critical criteria cited earlier for justifying special recovery, namely that costs change dramatically or unpredictably or are substantial in nature or are beyond the control of the utility. Mechanisms shown on slide 10 there, on average, account for a smaller portion of annual utility jurisdictional revenues, far less than fuel, for example. So the utility's inability to automatically recover these costs would not pose a financial risk anywhere near that of associated with fuel costs. So that in terms of the dollar impact, they're less on an annual basis. Also, although the associated costs for each category can vary somewhat, there is perhaps some unpredictability. They're not typically the kinds of activities that would be expected to produce dramatic, unpredictable changes. They're probably more manageable. However, an argument can be made that these costs are beyond the control of the utility because the one common thread that they have is that they are prompted by some public policy requirement placed on the utility. Automatic recovery mechanisms were permitted in those instances to remove disincentives to investment in the areas that were compelling from a public policy perspective, but not necessarily from a purely economic perspective. The use of these special mechanisms raises a question about whether their use has had a significant impact on overall rates. And that, of course, was one of the questions that was raised in the legislation and to which I will now turn. Slide 11 talks about the impact on rates. Given the sort of special circumstances surrounding fuel costs as I've been discussing them, I think it's fairly clear that the use of special recovery in that case probably helps to curb upward pressure on rates by avoiding the need to have filed constant rate cases to address these changing conditions. So I think that's sort of a conclusion. I think it's a conclusion of the report that there's a pretty clear case for that. Although I should add a caveat, and that is that there is a temptation to occasionally want to lump things into the fuel clause that arguably may or may not necessarily be fuel, just to allow that automatic recovery. And that's something I think that needs to be, you know, everybody needs to be aware of and is. But that is one minor risk with that.
Dr. Haar.
Yes.
Can you elaborate a little bit on why the rate recovery would prevent the rise in or significant rises? Is it just the cost of the rate recovery process itself that would be minimized? Is that what you're talking about?
Madam Chair, yes, thank you for that question. That's primarily it. Yes, the use of the special recovery mechanism in the case of fuel costs is a way of, without that, utilities probably would be filing rate cases very frequently. because those costs change, their operations change, and the special recovery mechanism sort of takes that offline and allows those changes to flow through, whether they go up or they go down. Sometimes they go down, and there are reductions or you know credits for that. So it works both ways, but it's a way of dealing with that very, very significant cost factor for utility operations without having to go through the rate case process, which, as we pointed out earlier, you know, has very, very specific components and just complicated and takes time. Okay. Time and resources.
Senator Metzen.
Mr. Haar, who would determine the threshold on this recovery mechanism? It seems to me it would be more like an autopilot, and the PUC, maybe there could be some bypassing of the commissioner. Am I missing something? I mean, I think most every rate increase ought to be reviewed and looked at by the PUC and not on so-called autopilot that I could get out of this.
Yeah.
Dr.
Madam Chair, Senator, thank you for that question. Yeah, the fuel adjustment clause, purchase gas adjustments, are very definitely reviewed. It's not something where there's a...
They just do it. I understand
that.
Yeah,
there's an annual review of those costs to make sure that they are legitimate and that they're, you know, they're prudent, and it's not something that is just totally offline.
No, so. I understand that, but I don't know what the, Madam Chair, what the threshold, who... You know, where the numbers are that they have to go to the PUC and how you let some, even though they're reviewed, let them get through. And I don't know where. Does that make sense?
Madam Chair, there's an annual process. We have a number in queue right now, and the utilities, I have very specific requirements in terms of the information that they need to provide to the Office of Energy Security, who does the initial review of that, and then they make a recommendation to the commission, and it is a proceeding, an ongoing proceeding where we go through this with every utility, pretty much on a continuing basis. Now I'll have to admit we're a little farther behind on that than we would like. It's sometimes we need to struggle to keep up with it, but it is reviewed and there are specific requirements utilities have to meet in terms of providing information.
Thank you. I guess I'm not familiar with all of the hoops and loops they have to, but you they convinced me that the safeguards are built in. And.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Haar, the annual review of the special rate recovery mechanisms versus the cost to a utility of a full-blown general rate case, about what are we talking about roughly in dollar amounts there? And is the general rate case, those costs are generally recoverable, aren't they?
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, yeah, all of the costs, both for both the review of the special recovery, the fuel cost recovery, and the rate case are all recoverable in terms of our costs and through the rates, right? Our activities are fully fee-funded and recoverable and are reflected in rates.
About what is the cost of a full-blown rate, general rate review?
Well, that, Madam Chair, that Dr. varies Haar. A lot. rate cases take far more time than any other single kind of proceeding, I would say, by and large. Probably a few exceptions on some rulemakings and so on, but as a general rule, rate cases are the main events. And in some cases, they can be relatively non-controversial and go through without a tremendous amount of controversy, whereas others are typically the larger companies are going to have more issues and will take more time. So it varies considerably. I don't have a number that I could give you right now, but I could go back and try and come up with a range for you on that.
I was just hoping whether it be a range of hundreds of dollars or millions of dollars or something, but that's fine, Madam Chair.
I was getting that
out. Okay, Dr. Haar, you can continue.
Okay, thank you. Looking then back at the impact on rates, as I was saying, the it seems that the rationale for the fuel recovery mechanism is fairly well established for the reasons we've already talked about. The non-fuel related recovery mechanisms that have come to pass in the last few years are it's a little less clear there. Even though the amount of revenue in those instances is shown on an annualized basis anyway is less certainly than fuel costs, there are some issues that have developed. One is that they've generated more regulatory activity. I think if you've had a chance to look at the report, we provide you with some information on the amount of hours that the Commission has had to spend on non-fuel-related special recovery mechanisms, and that's gone up fairly significantly since 2005. Also, those individual filings, those non-fuel are individually taking more time than perhaps used to be the case. Also, automatic recovery, as it suggests, assures that the utility is going to recover its costs, whatever those costs are, obviously subject to a review of ultimately. But the concern is, and maybe this is more a theoretical concern, but there is a concern that it's going to have an impact on incentives for efficiency, on incentives for cost control, that if the costs are automatically allowed to pass through or without being part of a more complex and involved rate case process, it will have an impact on incentives for cost control. So those two factors together, more rate case or more regulatory activity and just the impact, but potential impact on incentives, suggests that there could be greater upward pressure on rates. Another factor we mentioned here is the fact that these special recovery mechanisms, where we create them for certain categories of costs, limit the scope of costs that can be considered in a rate case proceeding. It takes those costs sort of effectively offline, takes them off the table, so that in evaluating all those things that are going up and some that are going down and trying to balance them out and try for the Commission to try and figure out, you know, what's the proper revenue requirement, what's the proper rate design, and so on. It basically ices those items and takes them out. So it limits the scope of what the Commission can consider in a rate proceeding. So it has that kind of impact as well. Also, since these specially recovered revenues are already accounted for in special cost mechanisms, they do not need to be included in a rate case request. In other words, the rate case request doesn't necessarily need to reflect the full implications, the full rate implications for ratepayers. On the other hand, as the fourth point points out there, the share, their overall share of annual revenues of the non-fuel related mechanisms that we've seen here in Minnesota still remains fairly small in terms of an annualized basis. Not to say that some of these projects that they're being used to fund aren't large and Andy. Significant in terms of cost, but in terms of the annual revenue impact, they're still substantially smaller than for fuel costs. All right, so while the use of non-fuel recovery mechanisms may create upward pressure on rates and tends to limit the scope of rate cases, the use of special recovery mechanism in Minnesota to date does not appear to have caused rates to be significantly higher than they would have been in the absence of those mechanisms. Another factor the commission or the legislation asked us to look at was the impact on customer understanding. And generally here, customers, our experience is that customers tend to focus on the total bill and how it fits into their income and how they balance it with all the other important expenses they have to deal with. Generally, the customers we hear from are less concerned with what are the components of the bill, and it's more the total. However, with that said, we have received in recent years a growing number of inquiries about the additional charge types that are appearing on bills, some of which are due to the special recovery mechanisms. So it's not a hue and cry, but there has been an uptick there, a slight uptick. Many of these concerns, most of these concerns, I would say, are probably about the complexity of the bill. That's not so much the specific mechanisms, but the complexity. But there are a few that have opinions about the specific mechanisms. So I think, by and large, customer awareness of the use of special recovery mechanisms remains, you know, relatively low by our experience. If it is agreed that there is a need for some special recovery mechanisms for utilities so that to remove disincentives to certain kinds of investments or expenditures, but we have concerns about the effects of widespread use of a variety of a sort of, as one author put it, a hodgepodge of special mechanisms, then the question becomes, are there viable alternatives? And I'm looking at slide 13 now. The types of special recovery mechanisms that we focus on in this report and that we have in Minnesota are but one form and that can be used to accomplish that removal of the disincentive. The report goes on to briefly discuss some of the other options. For example, construction work in progress is certainly a mechanism that can be used, and we have used in Minnesota for some time, actually. Pre-approval is another option, and of course, just last session, legislation was passed to allow pre-approval for expenditures on certain kinds of emission reduction projects. So that's now available in that I guess limited way, but it is available. Securitization is another option that has been used, not in Minnesota, thankfully, in my opinion, but in some other jurisdictions, and it largely occurred during the time that many states were looking at deregulation, and it has its own set of issues, which I won't go into right now. I'm not going to take time to get into the specifics of those, but I do want to focus on talking a little generally, a little more specifically, I should say, about the other option, which is listed there, the second bullet point, the earnings sharing mechanism. This is the option or is an alternative that probably most directly looks at and addresses this issue of more effectively managing the numerous individual mechanisms. And in effect, what a earnings sharing mechanism does, and this is sort of a generic term that's used, the earnings sharing mechanism, it basically replaces an array of special recovery mechanisms with one mechanism based on overall rate of return. An earnings sharing mechanism allows rate adjustments outside of a rate case proceeding for both instances where actual costs deviate from the level of costs identified in the test year used in the most recent rate case, and to the actual revenues deviate from some test year revenues. So slide 14 goes into a little bit more of the detail on earnings sharing mechanisms. In essence, they are a plan governing rate adjustments outside of a rate proceeding. These can be structured in any number of ways, and the report includes a couple of examples. Formula rates was one, and a multi-year rate case approach was the other one cited, and there are other options too. But, of course, the devil is in the details on any of these things, and there are lots of careful discussion and thought put into developing the structure of an ESM if that's something that's going to be pursued. Typically, with an earnings sharing mechanism, initial rates are set in a full rate case proceeding, and then pursuant to a periodic review of costs, revenues, and earnings, rate adjustments are prescribed according to whatever formula the plan basically sets out. An earnings sharing mechanism would involve a return on equity band, it's called, an ROE band, which is a range around the authorized return set in the rate case, so that as long as the earnings fall within that range, there's no rate adjustment. It's just sort of the rates are just set, and that's it. If the earnings veer outside of that band, if they go below it or go above it, then that would trigger an adjustment under the plan, under the rate earnings sharing plan. So that's generally how they work. Of course, as with anything, there are advantages and disadvantages. And yet, first, in terms of the advantages, looking now at slide 15, earnings sharing mechanism can reduce the need to administer numerous separate mechanisms, which is an issue. Obviously, it replaces all those mechanisms with one overall mechanism based on rate of return. The use of a earnings sharing mechanism should reduce the frequency of rate cases and should put them on a time sequence or a time on a schedule that's more predictable, which would be a significant advantage from the commission's perspective, so that we know when cases are going to be filed and that there a sort of a process can be established that's more manageable. It would make it more manageable. And because it reduces the – because an ESM, rather, reduces the delay between the changing cost conditions and the ability to adjust rates, an earnings sharing mechanism can result in rates that more closely reflect changing market conditions. In other words, they provide better – they can provide better price signals. Finally, unlike special recovery mechanisms that pass along – only specific costs for, you know, certain kinds of expenditures, pretty much like the mechanisms we have in place now, an earnings sharing mechanism would take into account the utility's overall profitability before allowing any kind of adjustment, so that even if certain cost categories were increasing, there wouldn't necessarily be a rate adjustment, you know, unless the overall earnings warranted it, according to whatever the dictates of the plan might be. So, and finally, as sort of a part of that, an earnings sharing mechanism can be structured to provide then for a sharing of benefits with ratepayers. For example, if earnings go above the return on equity band so that they're higher than expected, there can be provisions built into the plan to allow and share some of that savings with ratepayers. Turning to slide 16, the disadvantages. There are some of those, and it kind of gets back to things we were saying earlier. As mentioned, the earnings sharing mechanism would establish a special recovery mechanism in one special recovery mechanism, which would be based on earnings, as one commentator put it. It basically puts the future of the utility on autopilot, and an argument can be made that this would have an unexpected adverse effect on utility incentives along the lines of what I was commenting earlier. Now, you could build in performance metrics into the plan and other provisions for sharing that could help offset that somewhat, but still it is a concern that there would be effects on incentives for cost control. Anytime you shift risk away from a utility, which an earnings sharing mechanism would do by making their revenue streams more predictable, that risk has to go somewhere, and of course where it goes is typically to ratepayers. So there is a tendency with these to shift more risk to ratepayers. Of course, the devil, again, is in the details, and there are provisions that can be built into these mechanisms that will help control that and offset that, but that is a fundamental concern. Also, there's a potential for periodic rate adjustments. That's kind of the whole point of these mechanisms, and that will have an impact on customers. Customers could potentially see more rate adjustments, and if there are increases, that's liable to be not so warmly greeted. So there is, for sure, a customer impact. It would be a significant change, over the traditional rate-making processes that we've had in place and that are defined in our statutes and we relied on for many, many years. So it is something that if it were to be pursued, I think would have to be pursued with a fair amount of debate, discussion, and analysis and with our eyes as wide open as they can be. The final issue raised by the legislation was whether there are ways to improve the current system, special recovery. There are deficiencies that can be gained, and I think it's fair to say that we have such a variety, we have such a number. We have, I think there are, including the fuel clause, there are 20 special recovery mechanisms now in place. Such a variety that and because of the administrative challenges involved, there would have to be some fairly significant adjustments made. But whatever it is, we would hope that there would be a focus on reducing the administrative costs, because that's certainly an issue for us, and it's an issue for the utilities, and I'm sure you'll probably hear some of that from them. Also, we think there should be more specific provision for ratepayer sharing and building in greater accountability into this. So that was one of the comments that Office of Energy Security suggested, for example, about developing specific performance metrics as part of these mechanisms. So there's potential for that, but those are some, I guess, minimum basic objectives that I would suggest and that the report suggests focus on. The report offers three options by which to look at going forward. Allow special recovery only when utilities demonstrate severe financial risk, and recover everything else through a rate case process, which is sort of the old traditional way of regulating. It's sort of the old-time religion, I guess you could say. Basically, don't allow a lot of special recovery mechanisms, and only do it in instances where there's obvious, significant financial risk involved, and then do everything else through the rate case process. Sort of on the other extreme is go to some sort of earning sharing mechanism where you replace all of the earning sharing mechanisms we have now and just lump them into one and base it on overall earnings and go that route. And as we just pointed out, there are advantages and disadvantages with that, but that's sort of the other extreme. I suppose the third option is maybe kind of a middle ground, is reduce the number of special mechanisms that we have and allow only those that are most commonly used or involve the most significant financial risk, and then try to build in greater accountability for performance provisions for sharing of any efficiency gains with ratepayers, that kind of thing. So that's sort of an array of options that hopefully would provide a basis for further discussion. Conclusions then, slide 18, as I mentioned earlier, the fuel-related recovery mechanisms account for the largest share of revenues collected through these special mechanisms. Because they're large, fuel costs are large, can change unexpectedly, and are beyond the control of utilities, use of special mechanisms in their case helps, we believe, to curb upward pressure on rates. Non-fuel-related special mechanisms account for a smaller share of revenues annually, and expanded use of such mechanisms can, we believe, add upward pressure on rates. Slide 19, customer understanding of utility rates is primarily focused on the total bill. There's limited awareness of the role of special mechanisms as far as customers are concerned. There are alternatives to consider if that's deemed to be in the public interest. They represent significant changes from what we're doing right now, or they can. And there are advantages and disadvantages, and the details of those would have to be fully vetted. And then finally, improving the current system should at a minimum focus on reducing administrative costs and trying to find provisions for sharing of benefits that might derive from these mechanisms with ratepayers. So that concludes my overview of the report, and be happy to try and answer any other questions members might have.
Thank you. Senator Coobley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Haar, you've clarified a couple of points that I had a question on, but in the National Regulatory Research paper that you provided with your report, mm-hmm. it talks about the possibility of an emergency filing where there were, was a severe financial loss, like you mentioned, kind of toward the end here. But, you know, I mean, I suppose that adds another piece that you're saying, you know, maybe we ought to, you know, shrink the number of possibilities we have. But, you know, in a loss that might occur in a natural disaster or something like that where it was fairly large, does the PUC have a way that those could be recovered without the regulatory lag that you mentioned earlier in your presentation?
Dr. Hart.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Kubley, in terms of totally unexpected natural disaster kinds of events, it would basically be a rate case filing, I believe.
Okay.
Janet, I don't know if you have any further knowledge on her detailed knowledge on this is much greater than mine, but fundamentally the main vehicle that a utility that finds itself in that circumstance would be, you know, would probably prompt a rate case if it was a significant cost.
Ms. Gonzalez.
Madam Chair, I would just add to that I don't think we've been faced with a situation where there's been such a, you know, like a New Orleans-type situation. I mean, I don't think we've been faced with one where there was that high level of issue. We've certainly had the issues with severe storm damage, flooding, those types of things. I mean, the other mechanism utility has is the possibility of asking for what we call deferred accounting, which allows them to kind of retain those costs for a possible future recovery, even if they haven't filed a rate case yet. That's something that's used very sparingly, and I'll admit I would generally recommend against, but it is a mechanism that has been used and can be used just to preserve the cost for future recovery. I would also point out that when someone does file a rate case, they get interim rates in effect within 60 days. So once it takes a little while for the utility to get to the point where they can file a rate case, granted, but once they do it, they get pretty immediate temporary relief.
Dr. Haar, in your report you mentioned that a standard for approving riders for the category of expenses should be extremely large and unpredictable, and it seems to me that some of the riders don't meet that criteria. Are there any that you would recommend that we repeal?
Oh, Madam Chair, you're really putting me on the spot here.
Sorry.
I think you know the criteria, sort of the standard criteria of, you know, large impact, unpredictable, beyond the control. That's a good set of criteria by which to evaluate whether or not special recovery is really sort of warranted. I agree that a lot of the writers we're talking about here don't fit that category. I would say that in evaluating the current list, if we were to try and prune that down, I guess you could say I would look at, as if it was just me doing this, I would look at those that have the biggest financial impact, and they're fairly easy to identify because some of them are being used more often than others because of, you know, emission control programs and that kind of thing. So they do have a bigger impact. Even though it's much smaller than fuel, it's still larger than most. And I would, you know, probably eliminate those that aren't used that much or are very small or trying to figure out a different way to address those concerns. So I would base it largely on the dollar amounts. I think that would probably be the most legitimate way of going about doing that.
Okay. Yeah. Senator Metzen.
Yeah, in the conclusions we talk, the primary reason for the recovery mechanism is the cost of fuel costs. Does that ever work in reverse? I mean, the fuel costs have gone down in the last year. I suppose the utilities all come in and say, well, cut me down a little bit because of the, does it work in reverse? I mean, because fuel costs have gone down, and I can understand a mechanism to maybe the recovery if they go dramatically up, but what happens now when they go down? Do you ever go the other way?
Fair question. Ms. Gonzalez. I'm going to ask her to answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Metzen, certainly on fuel costs, particularly the purchase gas adjustment, the gas side of it, if you remember in, 2005, 2006 heating season, prices were, I know we were seeing on the spot market, $10, $12 per MCF gas. not that most utilities bought on the spot market, but you did see the higher prices come through rates very clearly, and those have now come back down. I think the PGA is probably the best example of where, and fuel costs in general, but particularly the PGA, where costs actually do go down. Most of the other riders are really all for costs that go up, and there really isn't something that goes down. The only way they go
Madam
down.
Madam Chair, the other riders are not that significant, as you report.
Well,
so we don't dwell on those. I think it's the fuel thing you say in your own report that's the probably 80-90% of the issue, I would think. I'm guessing at that percentage. So, but do the rates go down when the okay.
Well, I'm not sure I understand either. That's the question I had. If there is a rate rider that allows pass-through of the rates when the fuel costs go up, do they stay up or do they go down again when the rates go down?
Madam Chair, Senator Mitchell, no, they do go down. As I said, the fuel costs are a pass-through. There's a monthly filing of the fuel costs that are basically looking at the past 2 months, I think. Anyhow, on the average, they look at the most recent, a very recent period, and yes, they go down. It isn't the rates per se, the fuel adjustment line goes down, and yes, people are paying less for the natural gas commodity. There's a delay, there's a 2 month or so, depending on the exact timing of it, delay both directions. But yes, rates do go both up and down on the fuel costs. The only thing I was going to say on the other is on almost all the other riders, except for SIP potentially, although they go almost 100% up, and there isn't a mechanism for them to go down.
Okay.
Madam Chair, you asked my question in a different manner.
Yes, I understand that.
So maybe the two of us got something.
We could work together, yes. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are railroad freight rates part of the fuel cost, thinking specifically of coal? Yeah. I know they've had some action lately with freight rates going up on delivery of coal.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, yes, I believe they are, and I understand that is a growing issue.
Okay. The utilities would like to address us, too, so thank you very much for your report. Yes, Representative Westrum.
If you can't see me over here, I've had my hand up three times. So.
I'm sorry, I didn't see it.
No, I'd hate to keep it up forever, that's great. Madam Chair, a couple questions. Dr. Haar, I think it was slide A13 you mentioned. The conclusion was it hasn't significantly raised our rates. How are they defining the word significantly? And then I've got a follow-up question on another matter.
Yeah. Dr. Haar.
Madam Chair, I was trying to provide sort of a summary conclusion, I guess, or summary statement as to the impact on rates. And the statement that I tried to make there is that while, yes, we do have a lot of special recovery mechanisms, and as we just pointed out, they seem to be biased towards cost categories that are going up and not down, so there probably is some upward pressure on rates. The fact remains that overall, on an annualized basis, the cost, the revenues collected by those mechanisms is pretty small as a percentage of the utility's overall jurisdictional revenue. So it's not like we have anything on a scale comparable to fuel costs, for example. Fuel costs are far and away much, much greater in terms of their impact. These special recovery mechanisms have a much smaller impact.
Representative Westrum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the fuel cost thing, and first of all, it ties into Senator Metzen's question, I think, and the chair's follow-up a little bit. But can you refresh my memory on how the rate is publicized or shown to the consumer? If it's a rate of let's just say 7.5 cents a kilowatt. How much fuel cost is
built into that rate, or is fuel completely outside of that rate, and the fuel adjustment clause would be on top of that, as I recall. But can you give us just a little 101 on what's in the rate when the consumer is seeing or hearing a rate of 7.5%? Or I've sometimes heard advertisements or claims, you know, we haven't raised our rates for 5 years, yet the fuel adjustment would go up and down. You know what I'm asking here?
Ms. Gonzalez will answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Westrom, how about a good bureaucratic? It depends. Generally, on most utility bills, if you're just looking at what the consumer sees, the fuel clause or the purchase gas adjustment is out there separately. But to back up a minute, a representative amount of fuel costs or gas costs are built into what we call the base rates, in other words, the rates that come out of a rate case. The fuel adjustment mechanism is used for changes from that amount that was built into a rate case. So I can't make this simpler, but it's both built into the base rate, what was thought in the last rate case to be a representative amount, and any deviations from that is shown generally, not for all utilities, but generally shown as a separate line item on the bill. And many of the utilities probably don't count that when they're talking about, when they're bragging about or not bragging about what's happened with their rates. But it's really both. Now, some utilities show things differently on the bills, and we've allowed different ways of showing things. But the fuel clause is a variation from a representative amount built into rates.
So, Madam Chair, follow up. Thank you for that answer. And it gets to Senator Metzen's question. There is a certain amount of fuel cost built into the 7.5-cent hypothetical rate here that I'm using for an example. How do you determine that? And to Senator Metzen's point, how would the consumer ever know if their fuel cost was only 75% of what they had built into that base rate to begin with? And what happens if that's the case? I think that covers my question.
Madam Chair, Representative Westrom, I'm not sure if I'm totally following it. For the electric utilities, we have a requirement that I believe annually or semi-annually that, at least for the regulated utilities, that they send a notice that it's very generic. It just says approximately X percent of your bill is for generation, X percent is for transmission, and X percent is distribution, X percent is other. That doesn't quite get at what you're saying, but we generally do that. I don't think there's a clear breakdown of exactly what component of the bill relates to what. That's one of the things that's looked at very carefully in a rate case, in a class cost of service study. Things are broken down in minute detail as to, you know, what component is contributing to what. But as far as a consumer on their bill knowing exactly what fuel is, now an Xcel Energy consumer may know that because they've changed how, a little different, because they've changed how they do their bills and have a fuel component that includes both the base amount that normally would be built into rates and the adjustment all into one kind of fuel category or gas cost of gas category. Some of the other utilities haven't gone to that type of a system yet, so it might not be real clear. But just to reemphasize on the up and down, even with a base amount built into rates, I mean, the fuel cost can go negative. I mean, it can be a negative number. It isn't always, isn't always a positive number. So, I mean, just because an amount is generally built into base rates doesn't mean that that amount can't go underneath that. That can go negative also. It can go negative as well as positive. So it's just a convenience. It's really just a regulatory convenience that the amount, there's no reason it couldn't all be out separately in a separate rider and not build any of it into base rates. There's no strong logic to that one way or the other. That's just the way it's been done.
Representative Wester.
I think you've kind of touched on it here, but
So I understand. Okay, the base rate, let's just assume that builds in, I'll use fuel just because that's an easy example with gallons. That builds in diesel costs for this generation plant is going to be, I don't know, I mean, $2 a gallon, $2.50 a gallon as a base fuel cost. Now, most of the time in the last couple of years, fuels, diesel has probably been $2.75 to $3.50 or $4 a gallon. So the difference over from $2.50 to $4 would be what would be on the fuel adjustment clause here, if you can just bear with me in my example. Correct me where I'm wrong or misunderstanding something. So somewhere you've come up with a formula to give the utility in a rate case $2.50 a gallon cost of fuel to produce this electricity. That gives them a 7.5 cent kilowatt charge back to the consumer. Are you following me so far?
I don't want to lose you. Yes, I think that's correct so far.
So let's, now the fuel adjustment clause would kick in if they have to pay $3 a gallon for this diesel fuel that they had $2.50 budgeted for. Are you saying then there's also a negative credit that shows up if they're only end up only paying $2 a gallon instead of $2.50? I think this gets to Senator Metzen's question. Does it ever go the other way? Am I understanding it right? Is that where it would get credited back to the consumer, and the utility doesn't pick up the difference as a windfall, do they?
Ms. Gonzalez.
Madam Chair, Representative Westrom, that's correct. On the fuel clause does operate rather differently than many of the other riders, but yes, generally that's correct. If the actual costs are less than what was built into rates, the fuel clause would go negative. So it's in effect a
refund.
A refund, if you want to look at it that way. Of course, it would be offset against the rest of, the rest of the bill. But yes.
Okay. One final question, Madam Chair, gets to this automatic fuel clause or adjustment pass through. I'm not sure if you're the one to answer this, or Mr. Haar, or maybe both of you can give me your perspective. I understand the benefit of it and the practicality of it. There's a part of me, though, however, that says at some point it removes or takes away the incentive, at a minimum makes it neutral, and potentially, if you're cynical, says the utilities may not pay attention to stuff that they should be as close when they can just pass it through to the consumer. What incentive do we have for them to still buy the best price fuel or energy source for their fuel? Let's just say coal is dirt cheap and nuclear is high priced. What would incent them to run more of their coal plants than the nuclear plants if they can buy coal cheaper? When they've got a pass-through, it doesn't matter. The consumers will pay it, so we can just run the way we've always ran. How do we deal with that incentive being neutralized here or taken away? Because if they had to meet a certain rate or cost of fuel, they would have an incentive to find the cheapest long-term fuel sources and change by the month or by the week or by the year of where they're getting their energies from, if they had to make sure that was part of how they made profit at the year end. Do you follow what I'm saying here?
Dr. Haar has a response for you.
I think so. Your first comment about, you know, the effect on incentives, any automatic recovery mechanism, I think I agree, has the potential for having that impact on incentives, and that's the risk with their use. There are obviously reasons why we, as a matter of policy, still entertain their use and utilize special recovery mechanisms. There are other factors that are taken into consideration, but certainly the impact on incentives is a big deal. I mentioned that more in the context of the non-fuel mechanisms, I guess, in my comments, but it certainly applies with equal gravity to fuel as well. It's not an exception. The commission's review process of looking at fuel costs and so on, as I said, we have it's basically an ongoing process that we're involved in, OES is involved in. We take a very close look at, you know, where are they getting their fuels, what is the market saying, try to make sure that those costs and those expenditures are, I guess you could say, prudently incurred. And we have very interested large users, particularly interveners, that oftentimes take a look at that information as well, because it's a big part of the overall bill. So it gets a lot of attention. And I think there you can take some assurance that those costs are being very, very closely scrutinized. As far as the longer-term issue that you said, well, how about coal versus nuclear? And that's really a very long, much more of a longer-term kind of proposition, and really involves a whole lot more factors, many of which having to do with the need, you know, the economics of operating coal plants versus nuclear plants, for example. And reliability requirements that the utility has to deal with. Fuel cost is part of that, but I think it would have to be a very, you know, sort of dramatic, long-term, sustained change or reduction, let's say, in one kind of fuel versus another to cause there to be a sort of a major shift in one direction or another. So that's one is a kind of a short-term proposition. The other is a much longer-term proposition, taking into a whole variety of other factors. I guess I don't see, in most cases, I don't see variations in fuel costs driving, you know, those kinds of decisions, unless it is a very, very sustained projection as to change. I don't know if Janet is.
Representative Hilty.
Madam Chair, between Representative Westrom's question and Mr. Haar's answer, I think my question has been answered.
Okay. Thank you. This time we're going to move ahead because we have only 35 minutes left and we have five speakers to hear from. And Bill Glahn, Director of Office of Energy Security, would like to comment on the report.
Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Thank you. I am Bill Glahn, Director of the Office of Energy Security, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Commerce. Thanks for giving me this chance. And I did want to take the opportunity, because I didn't talk to him before the hearing, before the meeting. Representative Junkie, I was in his district yesterday, very much enjoyed my visit to Wilmer.
So. Madam Chair, he was in the paper this morning in Wilmer, too. So if you didn't, I can send you a copy.
All right. Thank you. Madam Chair, since a lot of ground was covered between Dr. Haar and Ms. Gonzalez and the questions, I'll try to cover only stuff that we haven't touched on or touched on in much depth to try to speed things along here. And I did bring a copy of my electric bill, so we'll get some excitement with that. As Dr. Haar pointed out, a number of the comments that we made in this process were incorporated into his report. But some comments that I'd like to bring up that did not make in the report. A little context around the use of the riders. We heard about how the fuel clause has been in there for some time. The conservation improvement surcharge has been around for a couple of decades as well. But I would have to, you know, for my money, I'd have to characterize that the use of riders has really taken off in the last 10 years or so. And putting in a little bit of a context, at least I would date it to when we had the situation where the utility, I don't think it's me.
It's somebody's phone is sitting near the microphone. Okay.
So, Madam Chair, the situation where Xcel Energy had gone through a merger and was subject to a rate freeze and did not have the opportunity to avail themselves of the traditional rate relief mechanism of filing a rate case. Instead, we allowed some of these pass-through riders to go into effect. And so what I would characterize as a special circumstance, a merged utility subject to a rate freeze, and how do you make them whole for some extraordinary situations that had come along, has become the new normal, that, you know, it's a matter of course that we make some change and we allow a special rider for it. and we don't have some of the threshold questions of, you know, is it big enough to really matter, or is it something really beyond their control, et cetera, et cetera. So a little bit of history, I think, would been was useful to throw out there that, you know, we've gone from the situation where we're trying to cover something very extraordinary to where it's much more of a common everyday occurrence on these riders. And I agree with Dr. Haar that perhaps we've gone a little too far in that direction. The pendulum has swung a little too far. Again, we heard a little bit about the customer understanding issue. And I might take a little issue with how Dr. Haar framed it. You know, he seemed to be saying that customers really care about what the total bill is. They're not so interested in the components or these riders. And, you know, perhaps I just have a different mix of customers that I interact with. Some of them are very interested, keenly interested, not just in the total amount of the bill, but the different components, and are very concerned about what costs go into these riders. And one step further is the rate design, the cost recovery mechanism for these riders. It's for the most part, riders are collected on a kilowatt hour basis, so just a flat per kilowatt hour charge, regardless of what customer class you fall into, regardless of what underlying rate design is for your class. And so we spend a lot of this is kind of back to some of the issues we've talked about. And there's a I would say, I think it's more than a perception, I think it's true that in a rider case or one of these piecemeal rate-making proceedings, you just don't pay attention or get the scrutiny of those costs you do in a full-blown rate case where everything's on the table. And that's true not just of the absolute amount of the cost, but the rate design elements of it. So rate design is a very big issue, very contentious issue in rate cases. As you divide costs between the classes, as you divide costs between cost elements, whether it's the demand charge or the energy charge, and I don't believe that level of scrutiny is given to these extraordinary costs in these rider proceedings. I'll come back to that in a moment. But my last point before I return to the previous one was about what happens at the end of the day. We heard about how we try our level best, and I would agree with Dr. Haar, we try our level best in reviewing fuel cost or whatever rider costs we're talking about, either OES or the Attorney General's Office or interveners, to try to make sure that the costs are reasonable. And we do that item by item, piece by piece. And in the rate cases, I agree with the characterization. We've put all that aside, and we don't look at those costs. And we have the leftovers. We look at the rate case and try to make sure those costs are reasonable. But there's no element in which we bring it all back together in the end, and the bottom line on the bill is the bottom line on the bill still just and reasonable after we've done all of that. And we had the situation about 10 years ago with some of the financial incentives for the conservation programs, where we had the case when you had the recovery for base rates, which we all agreed in the last rate case were just and reasonable. Each of these riders we think are, as a piece, just and reasonable, but you put those financial incentives on top, and we had the situation where some of our utilities were over-earning significantly amount of, above the amount allowed in their rate of return. So we've lost the plot. We've lost the forest for all the focus on the individual elements. And there doesn't seem to be a process by which we can bring it all back together and say, okay, well, we did our level best on each component. Now that we've added the pieces together, is the total bill still just and reasonable at the end of the day? Or have some of these financial incentives and other mechanisms allowed the utility to, on the whole, over-earn? Bringing back to my bill and the issue of the customer understanding. So, you know, I think that we as policymakers and then we as customers benefit when we have more information and not less. And we're grown-ups, you know, we're all adults here, and I'm firmly of the belief if we have good information, we'll make good decisions, and we'll increasing the level of understanding will diminish the contentions or the contentious nature of some of these things, not increase it. So just to pick on Xcel Energy, of whom I have the privilege of being one of their customers, I brought my electric bill with me for this month, which I got a couple of days ago. And, you know, I have to say I've been in this business for 15 years, and, you know, we got the service charge, energy charge and the basic service charge, et cetera, and we have a line on here for resource adjustment. And if somebody were to come up to me on the street, Mr. Glahn, what's included in that resource judgment? I'm afraid I would have a hard time bringing to mind everything that goes into it. Luckily, they included a bill insert this month, which details each and every one of the items in the research adjustment. And for Mike Bull's benefit, if he's still here, I was going to read the list. It's the conservation improvement rider, the renewable development fund rider, transmission cost recovery rider, state energy policy rate rider, renewable energy standard rider, and the mercury cost reduction recovery rider. So those are the ones that Excel includes in their resource rider. And they are very helpful in putting the dollar amount, the per kilowatt hour charge of each and every one of those elements. I did want to call your attention to a couple of things. One is that of all of these, only one of them, the environmental improvement rider, has a split kilowatt and kilowatt hour rate. So if you're a demand customer, you pay a kilowatt charge of so much and a kilowatt hour charge of so much. And so that ensures that if you're a large industrial customer with a high load factor, that paying an amount per kW and an amount per kilowatt hour, you're not being disadvantaged if it were completely on a kilowatt hour basis. So if we recover all these costs on just the energy, a high demand or a demand customer with a high load factor would be worse off. And those are exactly the kind of behaviors we want to incent by having the rate design done right. So we have that. We have another one. The transmission rider is done by rate class. So residentials pay a different rate than commercials. And so we have some sense where we're going back to that rate design and cost causation work we do in rate cases to make sure that rates are fairly charged to the customers who are causing those costs. But none of the others have anything other than a straight per kilowatt hour charge. So that's an issue we haven't talked about this afternoon, which is significant. This is back to Representative Westrom's question about whether any of this is significant. Well, you know, that's in the eye of the beholder. My entire resource adjustment is $1.90. And that probably didn't justify the speech I just gave about it. But if I were an industrial customer, that could be hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it's a significant cost. So when we say, oh, on the whole, it's not significant, you know, it depends on who you are. And these costs could be very significant depending on the size of your total bill or whether it's being recovered kilowatt hour or by rate class or by KW and all of that. And the final point I would make is, and just, again, feel sorry for Excel picking on them because I'm the Renewable Development Fund, there's several paragraphs on what the Renewable Development Fund does and what the rate is per kilowatt hour. Not one mention of the fact that it's linked to the nuclear dry storage casks at Prairie Island. So I think we have a very good opportunity here to improve customer understanding of what we're doing with state policy, how we're charging customers to recover those costs. And I always fall on the side of more information is better. Better information is better than little information, and that will all benefit in the end if we provide that information back to the customer. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deputy Commissioner, in your statements, are you arguing for less or just more information or more, you know, as far as the cost recovery mechanisms? I'm not sure if I followed you. It seemed like you're just wanting more information so that we understood where the money was coming from or going to. Is that correct?
Director Glenn.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, thanks for asking me that question because in the end of the day, I would say I'm in favor of fewer mechanisms. We can probably have a different discussion about the fuel adjustment clause, but for the most part, the idea of piecemeal rate making, looking at one cost outside the context of a rate case where you have all the costs and revenues on the table, is something that I don't think benefits customers. Now, we can argue about how much they're harmed by it, but I don't think they benefit by it. And back to Senator Metzen's question about that threshold issue. Now, I just happen to be paying my summer rate here 7.3 cents a kilowatt hour for my energy. And a couple of these riders don't kick in until two places farther past the decimal than that. So they're 1/100th of the cost that I'm paying for my basic electricity. And you wonder whether that justifies the administrative cost and all the attention we would pay to that one line item element. So we have the argument about the piecemeal rate making, but also that materiality argument. Are some of these costs really that much that we need a separate item for it?
Okay. Follow Senator Dahl.
Thank you. Then on the, I know in the PUC's presentation, they're talking about this earnings sharing mechanisms that they're talking about. Are you, what is your position on that? And they mentioned that there was some performance measures that OES was thinking should be included. Is that something that OES is currently working on as far as compiling a list of what those performance measures might be?
Director Glenn.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, we listed a number of them in our comments, and I'd be happy to share them with you and the committee offline. But we are working on that. We have a number of ideas we put in there, working on some more ideas. As for the earning sharing mechanism, I would not support that for many of the reasons that Dr. Haar pointed out, the shifting of risk to ratepayers from the utilities, who are in a much better position to manage those risks, and what I think are the negative incentives it gives to utilities on cost containment, and I would add to that list on performance. If you're going to collect your money, whether you deliver a thermogas or deliver a kilowatt hour, that might diminish your incentives to maintain your system and keep your uptime right. Now, I'm sure the utilities could say that they'll do a great job anyway, and we can always go and put in metrics and standards that they would have to meet, but then we're going back and trying to undo some of the damage we did from what we did with the mechanism to begin with. So I would not support that.
Okay. Madam Chair. Thank you. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Glenn, in terms of the kinds of disclosure that we currently make on utility bills, I've always found it kind of interesting that there isn't really any connection between the costs incurred in meeting these various public policy obligations that are represented in the riders that are described in detail on the bill. As you pointed out, some of those are pretty inconsequential and would not really need to be disclosed on the bill at all, because it really doesn't have any significant impact on what you're paying. One of the things that is absent from the bill that people might be equally interested in, they presumably are in all of the public policy costs involved in producing electricity, would be things like how much does the utility spend on lobbying or on executive bonuses or on PR advertising. I think we ought to include some of those expenses in the bill as well.
Director Glenn.
Madam Chair, Chairman Hilty, your point is certainly true that if we go through a standard rate case, we don't have a separate line item on the bill for cost of maintaining their fleet of bucket trucks. You know, that level of detail we don't include. It's just all rolled into that 7.3 cents a kilowatt hour or the service charge that we pay every month. That being said, utilities and the legislature hasn't authorized a separate charge for maintaining bucket trucks. And so if we're taking an extraordinary step beyond our normal course of business, then I think we do owe it to the consumer to explain what we've done and what impact it has on that bill. But, I agree with your general point. More disclosure is better than less, if I understood that to be your point. And this is already a fairly significant amount of text in one flyer, and at some point you get a three-ring binder to every customer, and who's going to read that? So you do have a balance between trying to give good, useful information to customers and just overwhelming them with stuff that they may or may not be all that concerned about.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deputy Commissioner Glenn, to Representative Hildy's raised a line of questioning I was thinking about asking about, then thought, in the interest of time, we'll let it go. But since it's up, I give it as brief and concise as answer as possible. What are the sources of money for a regulated utility? No, the answer is shareholders and ratepayers. I can't think of any place else they get it because they don't print it. And then the question is, if it's an authorized rate of return eligible expenditure, like operating a transmission line, versus one that you can't capture rate of return on, like, say, paying lobbyists, where does the money come from? How's it accounted for? And I think I know the answer, but perhaps you can educate us as to how those people get paid, because they get paid out of only those two sources of funds, if I can, unless I'm missing something here.
Director Klein.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, I think did bring up a good cost, that not every cost incurred by a utility is eligible for recovery from ratepayers. Mm-hmm. So they do a lot of activities, some of which we've mentioned in the last few minutes, that are not baked into the rates in any form. So, you know, we have to be a little careful of that. Bondholders would be another source of funds as well. But, again, we have a tension there between trying to disclose and not trying to confuse people. But I think your point is well taken, that we need to focus on just those things that the ratepayer is on the hook for.
Well, Madam Chair, I think it maybe today is not the day to answer the question, but at some point I think it would be helpful to us to have it clarified where those expenditures come from, because at some point, what, are you going to sell more stock so you can pay a lobbyist or so you can give an executive a bonus? I don't think so. I think it must come from the rate of return, and again, we can't answer the question now, and I don't want the PUC to come back up and take a whack at this. We can hold this question for another time, because I know there are people we'd like to hear from, but know that some of us think about this. Where does that money come from? Because I know they can't even borrow money without having the structure of the debt and the interest rate and all those obligations have to be approved in a regulatory filing. And I would think the interest on the debt, does that come from the rate holders? Is that recoverable? Or does that come out of the rate of return they're authorized to capture, and so on and so forth? So
I'm not asking a question. It might be worth a response from the PUC. What is the relationships between the rates and the risks versus the profits, or what proportion of the rates are allocated to the profits?
Well, it kind of goes back, I guess, Madam Chair and Representative, to one of the slides I had in the presentation that showed the various components of the revenue requirement and one of the provisions in that.
Slide number four.
Yes, thank you. Slide four was the rate of return, overall rate of return. And without getting into the minutiae of that, we'd be thrilled to come in and talk to you about that in more detail if you'd like, but there are various components of that. Return on equity, return on common stock is one of those factors. The interest cost, the cost of securities, that sort of thing. Return on preferred stock, for example. We break it down, basically go through the full capital structure and assign costs and weights to each of those. Those are all elements in the calculus of doing that. Return on equity is the largest single and most controversial component of that, and that looks at comparable returns for comparably risked utilities, and it takes into account the kinds of risks that the utility here, the Xcel or whoever it is facing versus, you know, a similarly situated utility somewhere else, and we try to make judgments as to what's the proper rate of return to reflect that risk, and so that's where most of the focus on determining the rate of return goes. The bond costs and long-term debt costs, those sorts of things are pretty well fixed.
We did have, in the Senate, we had a hearing on this and a report, and it might be worth it for us to schedule an LEC meeting to go over this in more detail.
Well, I noticed that Dr. Bahar did use the word thrilling in trying to describe how this hearing was going to go. I'm looking forward to that thrilling hearing.
I understand where I'm going.
To sum up, I believe, Madam Chair, I believe that the expenditures that are not allowed, like lobbying and executive bonuses and other things, probably reduce the return to the stockholders, and that's probably where that pot of money comes from. Is that a correct assumption? And yes,
Chair,
or no,
yeah.
Dr. Hart.
Expenditures that are not allowed, which are, I'm sorry if I missed the question. Yes. There. Yeah, they that that burden goes to the rate or to the stockholders.
I'm thrilled with the brief answer. Thank you, Madam
Sorry.
Chair.
Sorry.
Okay. Thank you. At this time, I'm going to call up, thank you, Dr. Haar, and thank you, Director Glahn, too, for your comments. I want to call up both Scott Walensky and Margaret Hodnick. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Walensky, would you like to start?
Thank you. My name is Scott Walensky. I'm Vice President of Regulatory Affairs and Resource Planning for Xcel Energy. I want to thank the Commission and appreciate the thoughtful and thorough work that went into the study and your willingness to take time out of a busy summer afternoon to actually listen to utility rate regulation issues, which, as Dr. Haar indicated, can sometimes be the brink of thrilling. I think one of the key points that's been absent from this discussion today, and one of the things that I think is acknowledged by the report but probably deserves more emphasis, is the recognition that the electric utility sector is in a very dynamic period. We are responding to state and federal policies, and those policies are encouraging us to rethink how we provide service to our customers. It seeks to change out our generation mix to make our fleet cleaner and to add more renewables to our system. It recognizes the need that in doing so we need to build more transmission to bring those renewables to market and that we need to provide a greater degree of reliability. And finally, at the same time that we're adding costs because our old plant has been largely depreciated and we're adding more expensive new plant, we're actually being encouraged to reduce our sales. Under state policy, we're trying to achieve aggressive targets of 1.5% of our sales growth being reduced each and every year. So we have a situation where we have a state policy that has going to reduce long-run costs, but in the short run, there will be price impacts to customers. And we need to talk about how to address those. Riders have been a tool to deal with that mechanism. There are others, and we'll talk about that in a minute. One of the things that is that Dr. Haar talked about in his comments are the substantiality test. I would just want you to think about one other factor. Our investment mix has involved a number of large projects, and I would just highlight a few of those in a moment. But they've also involved a number of large projects that have come online or into service when they become eligible for rate recovery year after year. And so it's not the traditional sort of you have a plant, you wait 4 years, you get on another plant as load grows into it. We've been doing projects back-to-back sequentially. So we simply cannot wait to complete a single large project and file a general rate case. With this substantial increase in investment, we've needed and asked for authority for more timely recovery of our costs, much more so than in the past. And that reflects the dynamic market that we're in right now. Timely recovery is critical to our ability to raise the additional capital required by this effort, while at the same time maintaining the financial health of the utility. It is probably the single largest factor that our investment community looks to in terms of can you afford a larger investment program than your peers? Can you actually go forward and make investments today that are beyond your depreciated capital, your cash-free capital that they look at as sort of a benchmark for utilities? We have been, if you go beyond that point, you are in capital markets borrowing money, raising equity. And financial markets are fine with that if there's a supportive structure for recovering those funds. They are not fine with it if there is not a mechanism for that to occur. Just to give you a brief idea what this means in real dollars from Xcel's perspective and the jobs that have been created, starting in 2006, and I just would like to make one small correction, our rate freeze ran until 2006. No special rider amounts were included until our 2006 MERP filing, which was the very first time we included an investment in a rider. So we waited the end of the rate freeze before that occurred. But we spent $1 billion for the Metropolitan Emission Reduction Projects. We repowered two coal plants to natural gas, and we fully retrofitted and brought to best available control technologies a third coal plant. The three MERP projects were put in service sequentially in 2007, 2008, and 2009. Each of these projects individually, when combined with the other investments we're making on our system on a normal basis, would have driven a rate case in every one of those years. And without a special mechanism, we would not have been able to undertake that level of investment. We're going to invest about $1 billion or more in wind, 450 megawatts of wind in Grand Meadows Wind Farm, our Nobles Wind Farm, and our Mericourt project. The last two of these are bigger projects and a little more expensive because prices for wind have gone up a little bit. And they would be significant enough to drive rate cases in 2011 and 2012 when they're planning on going into to be placed in service. We've spent about $350 million for our first two sets of Buffalo Ridge transmission lines and invested another and have plans to invest another $1 billion for our CapEx 2020 lines. As you know, CapEx 2020 is not only bringing significant new transmission to the state, but it's doing so very wisely because for the very first time, all of the state's utilities have engaged in a joint planning process to make sure we're picking the best routes and the best lines to serve the needs of the entire state. Today's construction cycle is unique. The last large construction cycle for the utility industry was in the late 70s and early 80s, but that was supported by a large number of rate cases and by substantial revenue growth. As I mentioned earlier, we are being encouraged to reduce sales growth, and the amount of revenue growth on our system is much lower than it had been historically. So without the mechanisms that you have provided, we simply could not have undertaken the amount of capital expenditure that we have done to benefit both the state and our customers. Just to give you an idea of those benefits, our MERP project reduced SOX and NOx by 90% at those three plants, and we reduced our carbon emissions by 2 million tons a year. We've diversified our energy mix with wind. The wind does have a cost that you're seeing go through a rider, but it's avoiding a fuel cost because it's got a zero fuel cost. We need to take that into account when we're looking at the actual price of the project. We're on a path to reduce our carbon emissions consistent with state policy by 20% by 2020. We're not quite to the point where this policy gets us, but we're striving to get there, and we're doing so in a very cost-effective way. And we've managed to do all of this and remain a competitive regional supplier. I've looked at prices compared to our neighbors in other states, and the prices that Mr. Galan was talking about are still very competitive. But it is important to remember, as pointed out by the commission report, that our more exceptional riders amount to a relatively small portion of our overall revenues, but a larger portion of our new investment in incremental revenues, things that we may not otherwise undertake. During the last 5 years, though, we've also added a number of costs that go through traditional base rates, and we have to await rate cases to change those. About every 4 to 5 years, we build a large power plant on our distribution system, about $700 million worth of investment, and we're going to add about $1 billion to upgrade our nuclear plants and to get their life extension for another 20 years. Those investments will provide low-cost power to our customers, and they will help us avoid 10 million tons of carbon dioxide a year compared to the alternatives. So again, very important benefits both economically and environmentally. And we have every incentive, because we can't file rate cases as frequently as we'd like, to try to minimize all of our operating costs, chemicals, health care, pension expense, that we can only recover in a general rate case. But given the magnitude of the investment that we have in front of us, and we've had a lot of collaborative work between this legislature, the commission, our state regulators, in trying to get to where we're at today, but the path in front of us isn't changing much. We're facing continued increasing investment needs, and we're facing slower sales growth. Just to put this in perspective, Our costs are going to projected to rise under current forecast by about 6% a year. Our sales are expected to rise about 1%. So there's a gap. And that gap's going to be there based on all the projects that have been approved to date for the next 5 years, without even starting into the next generation of projects. So just as the evolution of riders was responsive to new needs, rate regulation can and should continue to evolve. And the report actually refers to several mechanisms being used in other states that more comprehensively change rates on an annual basis. There are a number of ideas about what changes might work best. We think a multi-year plan looking at costs and revenues, say over a three-year period, rather than a traditional one-year period, is likely to be the best approach. One of the things that it will do is it will provide greater predictability about price increases. Our prices are going up every year with riders. This would put a more comprehensive package together about what the price to consumers would actually be in not just the first year when you have your rate case, but also the second and third year. It would need to build in protections for consumers, and it would have to certainly include appropriate incentives for us to maintain efficient operations. But a plan like this would also allow us to consolidate many of our riders and perhaps avoid new ones. It would also provide everyone in this room, our customers and our large industrial customers who make decisions based on our price, some agreement on what our cost trajectory should be as a state as we move forward and implement those public policies. And while there's no single right way to set rates and no single right way to address the accommodation and facilitation of investment, we think that we're very interested to listen to others and reach out to other stakeholders and regulators with a transparent approach in the next few months. I just want to share with you, because you're aware of some of the folks working on this, Al Krug, who you've heard from before, and now Mike Bull will be responsible to lead this effort. Mike, who you all know, is in our resource planning department. And resource planning looks at our future generation and makes the decisions about what mix of generation resources we should choose. And we've been integrating our resource planning and our regulatory functions because it's those decisions that drive our future costs. And they have the largest impact on our future costs of the system. And they also have an impact on the timing of those costs. So as we look over a longer period of time, we can understand what the cost impacts are to our customers and to the state. And so we'll try to engage them and keep you informed of the progress we make in discussing these new ideas and reforming regulation to meet our current and future needs. Appreciate the time.
Mr. Walensky, thank you. Before we go on, I regret to say that I have to leave. I have an appointment in Duluth. And so Representative Hilty has graciously agreed to continue the meeting at this time. But I would like to remind members that at the end of session, we talked about this being a very busy year, and members still wanted this to be a productive LEC commission. And so we agreed that we would set up meetings on a regular basis, and those that could attend would attend. And I'm really grateful for the large attendance today. This is probably the largest we've had since we started the commission. It's wonderful. But one of the things that we had talked about doing was to go to Austin to have a committee hearing there with the PUC, and we were going to stop and visit a wind farm at that time. And when we pulled the committee, we found that there wasn't any day that many people could come, and we just feel that it would be better that we have a large contingency that would be going to that meeting. So it was the week, I think, of the 16th of August, and we're going to delay that at this time and reschedule it later on. I think it's a very important meeting. We will be scheduling, however, I think during the week of the 24th, around the week of the 24th, or around the 24th, a meeting to a wind farm, and we'll let you know further about that. So, sorry, I have to leave. Excuse me, and I'll turn the meeting over to Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to clarify, I think my understanding is that the wind farm visit that Senator Pretner Solon referred to would be a tour organized by the commission, but not an official meeting. Ms. Hodnick.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Hilty and committee members. In the interest of time, I'm going to move through these slides that I believe have been shared with you that we provide in advance copies of. But before I get into them, I just want to say that Minnesota Power agrees with a number of the statements that Excel was making about the importance of riders as a policy supportive tool in the rate-making process. They have encouraged a lot of construction, which has been required of utilities for energy policy objectives and also just for maintaining our systems and replacing things that are getting old over time, just as we see with a lot of our highway infrastructure, bridges, and things like that. We've had to make investments, and we will have to continue to make those. And it's very important that we have a financially supportive environment from a regulatory standpoint to do that, and riders have a place in that, we feel. However, we can see from the report that was put together there are some issues and some things that could be looked at for fine-tuning, and we would welcome any opportunity to participate in looking at fine-tuning that aspect of energy policy. Turning to my slides, I plan to move through them quickly in the interest of your time. The first one just lays out what I was mentioning about what have been the drivers of a lot of this capital investment, the regional haze rule at the federal level, the Minnesota Mercury Reduction Act, the Renewable Energy Standard, and just ongoing maintenance and capital investment. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. And we have been going through a major period of this, and we see this continuing over the next period of time. And so if the state is interested in accomplishing these policies and sustaining the reliability of the utility systems, the state, I think, needs to encourage policies, regulatory policies that support this, because the money has to come from somewhere to do these things. It isn't just going to happen by itself. The next slide, the pie chart, and we're responding to a list of informal questions that were shared with us about the hearing and putting these slides together. The next slide just shows where since 2008, including our current rate case and our renewable rider and our transmission rider, where has Minnesota Power invested the vast amount or most major pieces of the money that has increased rates? And you'll see the largest portion on there is for environmental. And then reliability and renewable pieces have about an equivalent share. And then another source of increases has been benefits. But by the largest share you can see is from environmental projects, and that's emission reduction types of investment. If you go to the next slide that I have to share with you, I think this gets a little bit toward the questions that were being asked by Representative Beard and some others about the cost or the part of electric bills that have to do with profit and other where does the money go basically from an electric bill. And this that you have in front of you is our average customer electric bill at about $71. And the pie chart shows where out of that $71 does the money go. And this is a monthly bill. About half of it goes to produce electricity, so about 50% of it goes for electricity production. Another quarter of it goes to operations, and operations would be things like customer service, outage calls, you know, the trucks that you see on the road, call centers, that type of thing. So 75% of the customer's bill is paying for either producing the product or delivering it and servicing the product. Another 15% goes to taxes. And that's a significant share on the bill. And then about 4% you see for interest, a little better than 4%. And then when you look at the dividends plus the retained profit, that would be essentially the total profit. The dividend portion gets paid to our shareholders and bondholders, for their reward for giving us the money to do the investments and to run the utility. And that's why they give us the money to do it, so they can earn a return. So that's what the 5.2% is. And then the 0.4% is the profit that we've retained. And most of that right now we're plowing back into the utility as we continue to invest in it. So this is just a layout of where the money on the bill is going to. I don't know if there's any questions right at this moment, but I just wanted to share that. Chair Hilty.
Senator Rosen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Hodnick. On this particular slide, so your operations is also administrative salaries that would be included, and my other, that would, if you, administrative yes. cost would be in mm-hmm. operations. Your electric production percent, is that going up per year, or is that stabilized as far as percentage-wise?
I'm not sure if it's on a percentage basis, if it's increasing, but I believe numerically it's increasing because as we add emission control equipment to our facilities, we're having to add staff to operate the emission control facilities. We're having to add, use more reagents and sorbents, the material that you put in to with that equipment to absorb the emissions that you want to eliminate, so there's more material costs. So I think numerically it's going up. On a percentage basis, I can check into that and get that answer back to the commission.
Please proceed.
Okay, then proceeding to the next slide. This is one that I think some of you may have seen before because I know I used it in the last session. And I thought it was important enough to bring it back again today. And this is just a picture of how the regulatory model works. And the regulatory model is really an equation that's made up of several parts. And if you look at the left-hand side of this picture, you'll see debt holders and shareholders, and they're the source of the funds that utilities need to obtain to run the utility, to build anything, and to maintain operations. And so we have to go to the market to get capital from these people, and our capital structure is regulated by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. If you move to the top of the that diagram, you'll see electric facilities, which are really the rate base, the wind towers, the transmission lines, power plants. And electric facilities are regulated through things like certificate of need and permission to put them into rate base or collect on them in a rate rider. And so those are regulated, those facilities are regulated. And then on the left or right-hand side, are the customers who pay the rates for this service and this equipment. And our rates are regulated, obviously, by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. And then at the bottom is rate of return, which is what the commission authorizes after it examines our rate cases and looks at everything that's in the rate case. And the rate of return is regulated. It's an allowed rate of return. It's not guaranteed. And the point of this is that there are these multiple parts to regulation, and each one of these parts is regulated by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. And if you go to the next page, you'll see a smaller version of that picture, and with a headline there saying that balance is essential in looking at this equation. And what we really mean by that, there are individual comments on this page relative to it, is that all of these pieces need to be in play and effective with each other. In other words, we have to be able to raise capital on the left-hand side in order to run the business and build the things that we're being asked to build or maintain, the rate-based facilities. At the same time, rates, if you go to the right-hand side, rates have to be kept reasonable for customers. Otherwise, they're non-competitive for business, and they're not the right rates for residential customers. So those need to be kept in balance. And all of this is a balance, we believe. And the equation that's set up right now to do rate regulation in Minnesota has a balance to it. If we go to change it, and I'm not saying we shouldn't ever change anything in it, we have to be very careful because one unilateral change in any part of this equation could put that balance out of whack, and that could cause rates to become non-competitive. It could cause utilities to be unable to raise capital to build the facilities and maintain the facilities that are there. So the point is not that regulated models can't be improved or changed, but just that they are complex and intertwined, and we don't believe changes should be made unilaterally. They should be done on a considered basis. Moving to the next slide, this one is just really trying to provide a picture that there's more two regulation than rate cases. Rate cases are a really, really big part of the whole picture, but just to lay out that there are other proceedings that utilities go through and to be regulated on, and that's certificate of need, resources, resource planning, the riders that were discussed earlier, things like depreciation filing, service quality. Just to point out that utilities are examined in a variety of capacities, and that's just, you know, part of the reason why the Public Utilities Commission is such a busy place. There's all these other proceedings in addition to the ones that we've even been discussing earlier. And then the last slide discusses resource planning, and this was also mentioned in the list of informal questions that were supplied, and I think the intent of the question was, how do utilities decide to add a resource or get engaged in construction? And our basic premises are laid out here, and the first one is that we engage in construction based on customer requirements. In our case, we've got to take into account our unique customer base. We evaluate supply and demand options on a non-discriminatory basis to try to make the best choices. Our overall goal is to minimize the cost and have an appropriate rate while meeting all the societal requirements, such as emission reduction or renewables and that type of thing. Again, putting all that together in that equation we saw earlier. And I guess I'll just close with a comment on conservation, since that was also one of the part of one of the informal questions, and just about how conservation is treated. And I think one thing to think about relative to conservation is how sustainable is conserved energy as a supply. I mean, we might go through and retrofit all the lighting in the state with compact fluorescent light bulbs and lower demand, but then next year we all go out and buy flat screen TVs and raise the demand again. And so conservation is sort of a moving target. And in saying these things, I'm not indicating it isn't worthy and we shouldn't be going after it, and Minnesota Power is, and we've been fortunate up to this point to meet the goal, the 1.5% the state has out there. But just to understand that conservation is a more mutable resource, I'd say, than building a wind turbine or some other kind of a power plant. And that it's important with conservation when it comes to conservation policy, I think, to look at the outcomes that are derived from it and then make changes once you look at those outcomes. And we just recently, through the auspices of the commission, got a different incentive base set up for conservation that Minnesota Power is using now in its first year. And I would just argue that we should, when we make policy changes, give them a few years to play out and see what happens with them before coming in and radically changing them, unless we identify something that's, you know, just terribly wrong that must change immediately. We should give these policies a little time to play out so we can learn from them. And with that, I'll close my remarks and thank you.
Questions from members at this time? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And last on the agenda, Mr. Dougherty.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Jeff Dougherty. I'm the Director of Regulatory and Legislative Activities for CenterPoint Energy's Minnesota Gas Operations. CenterPoint Energy is the state's largest natural gas company with approximately 800,000 customers here in Minnesota. Batting cleanup here today. You'll be glad to know I have only 4 points I'd like to briefly touch on with all of you. And all of them could have an infinite level of detail, but we'll save those for later discussions with you. I'd like to just touch on briefly what a natural gas utility's total cost structure is, what drives a rate case for utilities such as ours, briefly discuss cost recovery riders, and then answer the question from our perspective, what's the most efficient process for setting rates on an ongoing basis. In the packet you have, you'll see on slide two a pie chart. And that pie chart depicts our cost structure at the natural gas utility. I'll point out a couple things on it real quickly. First, our net income of our total cost is 3%. So it's a very small fraction of the total cost of customer's natural gas bill. The next point I'll share is the big blue section, and that is the cost of gas. That does differentiate us significantly from a electric utility. Electric utilities aren't generation. We do not generate anything. We acquire natural gas in the open market for our customers. I believe the commission folks today shared with you that there's a purchase gas rider, and those costs do flow through to our customers after a detailed prudency review. And there's a good reason for the purchase gas rider. Natural gas prices, as probably you all know, have been very variable through a lot of the years. If in the last 10 years I've seen natural gas prices as low as $4 and high as $11, it has been a very variable commodity. And with that variability, there become difficulties in the rate-making process. For instance, if we did not have the purchase gas adjustment rider, and we had a fixed amount of gas price set in our rates for customers, and that price went down 6%, we could double our net income for a year. Or if natural gas prices went up 6%, it could wipe out our net income for a year. That would not be helpful to the regulatory process, to constantly be coming in and out of rate cases to adjust for that type of a factor. The next point is natural gas prices flowing through the PGA do set a price, proper price signals for our customers on a monthly basis. And so they are paying for the natural gas prices that the open market is dictating that that they should. The final point I'll make real quickly on this graph is over on the small section, which is really, that's a section that is of our rates that are adjusted in a general rate case. There's the conservation and gap program. Those are policy-driven programs from the legislature. We currently spend about $25 million on those programs. If we did not have the proper mechanisms in place to go to defer or have timely recovery of those costs, and we had to incur them, that could also drive us to a case if we didn't have the right proper mechanisms, because $25 million would equate to about 40% of our net income for the year. So I just want to set that in perspective a little bit for you. Next, what drives our general rate cases? That really depends upon the circumstances. Through the years, customers are using considerably less of our product. There's been declining use per customer, yet we continue to make significant capital additions in the state of Minnesota. Just to help put that in perspective a little bit, for the 10-year period of 1997 to 2007, we invested over $440 million in capital in the state of Minnesota, and yet the throughput or the usage for our residential and small business customers was basically flat, even though we added 142,000 customers. I mean, that's a business model that most businesses would not be able to sustain, and that's why we had to have numerous rate cases. One of the reasons we had to have numerous rate cases through the years. Just like the other utilities you heard talk about, we have other general costs that change, medical costs, pension costs. Even though the cost of our commodity goes through the purchase gas adjustment, it also impacts our business, our cash working capital requirements for our accounts receivable and those types of things, and we have to finance those through our banks, and so that does require changes in costs. But while we're talking about costs here, what drives a rate case, I think it's what's also important to realize that utilities such as ours have an incentive to stay out of a rate case. And to help give you a little bit of a picture of that, in 1982, our distribution margin that we charged to our customers was approximately $206 for each customer. If we inflation adjusted that into today's dollars, that would equate to $460. But our distribution margin cost that we charge to our customers is $250. We have been much more efficient through these last years, and there's a reason for that. Most utilities, I don't think, relish filing a rate case. All we do is get a black eye on this type of thing. And also, rate cases are very expensive. Our most current rate case costs approximately $1.7 million to file. So we prefer not filing general rate cases if we can avoid those. Next, on cost recovery riders, I think we've already touched on that a little bit. They cover costs that are variable and largely outside the utility's control. And that absent the rider would create tremendous risk for the utility, and the best example of that is the purchase gas adjustment rider. They can cover policy items such as conservation and the gas affordability program that the legislature has required us to do. And there are benefits for that. The riders are equitable. Customers pay for the actual costs incurred, no more, no less. There's increased transparency, even though I understand that they can create more review and more work. Most everybody understands those costs and what's going on with those much more precisely. They do send accurate price signals, particularly in the case of the purchase gas adjustment, and they do add to predictability and stability, which I believe Mr. Winsky and others have talked about a little bit. And that allows the company to attract capital at more favorable terms. Next slide, I'm not going to read to you. I'll leave it for you to take a look at. It is a quote from Moody's that talks about the types of things they look at when they take a look at how they're going to do their grading of utilities. That's important, how utilities grade is, for us to attract capital and attract at a good rate so that we can invest in the state of Minnesota at a reasonable rate. And part of these things they take a look at is, and we hear it from Moody's, we hear it from Standards and Poor's, we hear it from Fitch, talk about they look at alternative rate mechanisms that tend to provide additional assurance for timely cost recovery, and they see that as a positive. Finally, the question of what's the most efficient process for setting rates, I think the answer to the question of that is it depends. I like to do a lot of projects, construction projects, remodeling projects, and when I go up and to do a project, I don't take just one tool. I take a toolbox, because it just depends upon what I'm trying to achieve. Certainly for the costs that have large variability and are policy-driven, we think the trackers are extremely reasonable. However, if we're trying to take a look at how we may become more efficient in our regulation in the state of Minnesota, there are alternative approaches out there. And finally, I think about those alternative approaches and what we're trying to achieve. I think one objective of alternative approach to regulation would be to reduce the regulatory lag, allowing stakeholders to be more responsive to energy issues. Rate cases are very time-consuming, very resource-driven, and it will allow us to streamline that process. And finally, we could reduce the cost of regulation. And as I said, rate cases are very expensive. It costs about $1.7 million to do our last rate case. Finally, there's a model that we are familiar with. It's fairly similar to what's been described to you already by the commission today, so I'm not going to get into much detail on that. Certainly would welcome having more discussion about that down the road. The one point I'd like to make on that is that these rate adjustment mechanisms are based on an earnings sharing approach, and they can go up and go down. The model that we have used, I'm most familiar with in Oklahoma, has one of these earnings sharing mechanisms. And customers have had refunds 2 years, and the utility has rates have gone up 2 years. So it is symmetrical and has gone both ways. So, Mr. Chair, that concludes my testimony for today.
Thank you, Mr. Dockery. Are there questions at this time?
Thank you.
Members, as Mr. Haar pointed out at the beginning of his presentation, the report from the commission and the testimony that we've heard today was pretty much intended to be the beginning of a discussion, not the end of it. These are issues that I'm sure will be taken up in both bodies in the next legislative session, I think quite appropriately. Certainly, there are a number of public policy issues that are involved here, as Mr. Lewinsky and Ms. Hodnick both pointed out. Public policy is asking utilities basically to do things that are against their nature, so to speak, to sell less of their product and to deal with customers in ways that they have traditionally not done. I think there are a lot of issues surrounding that need to be worked out, and hopefully that's one of the things that we will be focusing on in the next legislative session. I look forward to working with all of the concerned parties on these issues. And I would just remind members that we probably will be organizing a tour of some of the wind farms and where siting issues occur in particular. In the near future, Mr. Suford is working on that. And As you know, Senator Pretner Solon will not be returning to the legislature. So I think partly because of that, we have made an agreement that the Senate would keep the gavel for the next Legislative Energy Commission meeting, and sort of a trade-off that would accommodate the senator's desire to do as much as she can with the commission before her term ends. So the tour notwithstanding, the next regular meeting of the commission, unless something changes about that, will be chaired by the Senate as well. And then we'll catch up with that later in the House. If there are no questions or comments, Senator St. John.
Chair Hildy, I don't know if anybody on the table has the answer. This one kind of question I have, and I don't know if there's an expert in the audience, but as conservation continues to move forward, and maybe even in addition to that, as the economy hopefully doesn't continue to decline, but if it does, would we, the body people of the state of Minnesota, given those two circumstances, expect to see higher rates? In other words, are the utilities going to have to make up their phenomena of lesser sales by increasing electrical rates? And I don't know if the answer to that was offered in some fashion today or not. I was trying to listen for it. I didn't hear it. I don't know if anybody around the table has any feelings like that or not. Any thoughts on that? But it's just a question that I have. Will lesser sales result in higher rates? And we can leave it open maybe for another day, but I think it is a significant question.
Well, it certainly is, Senator. It's sort of at the heart of the whole rate regulation question. It certainly has that potential, and I think it's up to us as policymakers to address that head on. And one of the problems that we have with a focus on conservation is that there's a conundrum that was expressed by an economist, I think, in the 19th century, or maybe the 18th century, a long time ago anyway.
I don't remember.
It's called the Jevons paradox, in which he points out that efficiency never leads to less consumption. And we have to be very careful in our conservation measures if what we're focusing on is to increase efficiency. As Ms. Hodnick pointed out, you know, we can get, we can change all of the light bulbs, and then the result is that we buy flat-screen TVs. And I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done in defining what our conservation and efficiency goals are related to consumption. Part of this discussion as well. Well, members, this meeting is adjourned.